The Trial. Athena had done her work before their arrival. She had whispered to the elders of Athens, who, surprised perhaps at their own wisdom, shrewdness, and foresight, had put together a court of adjudication. 12 judges were now seated on stone chairs on the Areopagus, the hill of Ares, ready to try Orestes' case. Witnesses had been summoned, and a large, excited crowd of citizens was sitting itself on the ground to watch and listen. Never had a forum of this kind been assembled in remembered or recorded history. Everybody was eager to discover how such a proceeding might work. The moment Orestes and Pylades arrived, guards took Orestes into custody, binding his hands behind his back and standing him on a raised stone facing the judges. It was agreed that Pylades could speak for his friend. He addressed the court with what he hoped was gravity and authority. "Is it really necessary, good citizens of Athens, for me to retell a story whose horrible details are so well known? Already our worst poetasters are making money with vulgar verses that cast my friend Orestes as either an avenging hero or a bloody assassin. Neither role is fair or just. He is a man, a son, and a brother who has been a puppet of fate since the day he was born. Many years ago, when he was but a child, his mother formed an adulterous liaison with their father's cousin, Aegisthus. Orestes and his sisters were banished from the royal apartments that were their rightful home and left to the care of a nurse and tutor, eating and living with the servants and slaves in the kitchen. All he could do was pray for the safe return of his father, Agamemnon, king of men, and the restoration of order in Mycenae. The great Agamemnon did duly return. Instantly, with a bestial savagery that, like one of Poseidon's great earthquakes, sent shocks through the known world, Clytemnestra herself, with cowardly, merciless cunning, ended the life of the noble warrior king. What she began, Aegisthus himself finished, slaughtering a Trojan princess and priestess of Apollo, Cassandra, in contempt of all laws of honour. Orestes and his sisters escaped to the court of King Strophius, where I have had the honour to know and love them, to grow with them from childhood, to witness the nobility of character and sweetness of nature that I declare before you to be the known virtues of this estimable prince. Did he dream of revenge? Why, of course. Which of you in those same circumstances would not? However, the actions he took were pure, honest, and validated by divine mandate. He betook himself to the oracle of Apollo at Delphi. There he was directly instructed by the Pythia, by the very mouthpiece of the god himself, directly instructed, I say, to avenge the murder of his father. For this, you would have him stand bound like some common criminal? One of the judges raised a hand to interrupt.
Forgive me, Prince Pylades. What you say is most compelling, but you must know that anyone may claim that they act under the direction of an oracle. But how can this be proved? What a lawless world we would inhabit were the mere avowal of oracular warrant to be admissible as an excuse for every crime.
Pylades paused, taken aback.
Honourable sir, you cannot expect me to demand the presence of the priestess herself to bear witness.
Let me say before you all, and before all the gods on Olympus, that I accompanied my friend, yes, into the very interior of the oracle. I stood by him. I heard every word directed to him, and I swear now, upon my life and the future of my soul, that what I have reported is the absolute truth. The priestess of Apollo commanded him to avenge the death of his father. It could not have been clearer. The judge waved his hand as if in assent. The citizens sitting all around sighed and nodded their approval. It seemed that everyone believed Pylades. And so, Pylades picked up the thread of his oratory, Orestes and his sister Electra, without any relish or crazed violence, exacted their revenge. Two unnatural criminals were executed according to eternal law and divine will. Were this the whole of the story? Any tribunal brought together to hear it would not only forgive Orestes, they would commend him. But there is more. Having obeyed the oracle, my friend then suffered the unendurable agony and torment of pursuit by the Furies. They have blasted his mind and his peace, robbing him of every feature that combined to make him the wise, sweet, honourable, and virtuous man I am proud to call my dearest friend. He is brought here for punishment, but my plea to the court is that it be recognised that he has been punished enough already, and that for justice to be done, the public acclamation of his absolution and exoneration should be made here and now by this venerable assembly. No, it is more than a plea. It is a demand. Pylades gave a short bow and stepped backwards. A murmur of appreciation greeted his final words. Even the judges nodded their approval. The same judge who had challenged Pylades earlier, he seemed to be the senior spokesman for them all, called for silence. And now, I believe, we have someone who will speak against the accused man. A young girl stepped forward. She was strikingly beautiful, her hair dark, her eyes flecked with green. She looked no older than 15 or 16. "And your name, please?" asked the judge. "I am Erigone, daughter of King Aegisthus and Queen Clytemnestra." A gasp, a murmur, a general shaking of astonished heads. Orestes staggered forward and almost tripped. Pylades steadied him. "Don't worry," he whispered. "I'm sure she will have nothing of importance to say." "Do you see her eyes?" said Orestes. "So like my mother's."
"What would you have us hear, Princess Erigone?" asked the judge.
"Well, my lord, I could stand here and demand vengeance for a girl whose beloved parents were snatched violently from her." Pale, trembling slightly but resolute, she turned to address each judge directly. "The lawful blood vengeance that would have been my right. But instead, I come to plead a deeper cause. Since the war at Troy and its blessed result, those kings, princes, lords, chieftains, husbands, sons, and brothers who survived the violence have returned to their homes. After such catastrophic bloodshed, we demand a new order, a new way of living that will never allow the gods to pull us into such a terrible conflict again. This court is a sign of that new order. It is a sign that the curses, blood feuds, and vendettas of our savage past are no longer to pollute our way of living. The gods themselves know that justice, fate, and law are older, deeper, and more powerful forces in the cosmos than they are. We men and women, we mortals, can achieve justice and obey the law in our own way without the capricious and brutal intervention of the gods. The primitive cruelty of oracular proclamations and divine revelations brings us nothing but sadness, terror, and rivers of blood, like the one that has brought us here. We speak here under the aegis of your patroness, Athena, whose qualities of understanding, judgment, wisdom, learning, and insight are the ones we most need now, if we are to reconstitute the world according to reason and sense, rather than impulse and bloodlust. She is the only god we need. I do not condone the death of Agamemnon, but he consented to and arranged the slaughter of his own innocent child, Iphigenia. As if this were not enough, he dared to cross the threshold of his wife and queen in the company of a Trojan captive with whom he planned brazenly and openly to consort. Was this not provocation enough? One or two of the judges nodded in sympathy, but what Erigenes said next astonished everyone. I say no. It was not provocation enough. I say my mother and father should never have slain Agamemnon. In doing so, they committed a monstrous crime. She allowed the fire, force, and shock of her words to echo around. But it grieves us all to know, she continued more quietly, that they did slay Agamemnon. They took him mercilessly, by surprise. Allowing the king of men no last words, no shriving or purgation, no chance to yield up his soul. His children, Orestes and Electra, knew that the murder of their father was a monstrous crime that went against all canons of natural law. But that was the moment the chain of vengeance should have been broken. How could taking the life of their mother, their own mother, be an acceptable act of retribution? We Greeks expect each generation to improve upon the one before. We like to believe that we invented the idea of progress towards perfection. Orestes had the opportunity to do more than repeat the violent pattern of his brutal ancestors. He could have done what we are doing now. He could have placed Clytemnestra and Aegisthus on open trial, allowing the citizens and wise elders of our community the chance to make a judgment and formulate a punishment. I accuse Orestes, therefore, yes, of an abominable crime against nature, but also of a hasty and arrogant assumption of the role of justice, a role which no individual should have the right to make. If we are to be an equitable and proper community, a society of wise and fair citizens, then we must make clear here, on the Areopagus, what we stand for. I demand that Orestes be punished for the sake of our future. Let his punishment be a warning to all those who might ever consider making justice and the law their own private affair. Now it was her turn to bow and step backwards, and for a murmur of approval to follow her address. The leading judge rose to his feet. The rhetoric and reason of both speakers are to be applauded, he said. This tribunal must now vote. He looked down the row to his left and then to his right. Firstly, do you find that Prince Orestes has committed a crime deserving of punishment? The vote shall be given as a yes or a no. If a majority votes yes, we will move on to the sentence, which can be death, banishment into perpetual exile, or ostracism for a named length of time, and which will be for us to decide. The judges coughed, tutted, whispered to each other, and at last finally quietened down. Pylades watched them closely for any sign of their voting intentions. He had been confident enough when he finished speaking that their sympathy was all with Orestes. But the force and weight of Erigone's words filled him with doubt and fear for his friend. The leftmost judge was on his feet.
Yes!
The next stood up.
Yes!
Merciful heavens! Pylades screwed his eyes closed.
No!
On it went, down the row. He thought he had counted 7 votes of yes before the last judge rose and declared aloud,
No!
The leading judge waved both his hands.
Citizens, we are tied at 6 votes in each direction.
People in the crowd began shouting the words,
Yes! And No!
Pylades would have feared for their safety had not a low boom sounded. A tall woman stepped from behind the row of judges. She was dressed in armor, and a light seemed to emanate from her. Athena. Pylades threw himself down, aware that everyone else was doing the same thing, crouching down, facing the ground, not daring to look.
People of Athens.
A voice that was somehow soft and personal, yet wide and commanding, sounded in Pylades' head. It seems that I have been left the deciding vote. I cast it in favour of Orestes, who is now pardoned and may go free, his name and honour restored. May this court be instituted to sit here, in this very spot in Athens, from this moment on and for countless generations. Its fame shall spread across the world, teaching how citizens, not kings or gods, may sit in fair judgment of each other. When that judgment is equal and undecided, then, as in this case, may the final vote always fall in favour of mercy and acquittal. The last echo of that huge voice had hardly finished ringing in Pylades' head before it was replaced by a most hideous chattering and rustling. He felt the temperature all around him drop. Orestes, who had fallen so hard onto his knees that they bled, now whined and cried out,
Will they never leave me?
Once again, Pylades heard inside his head the deep, sonorous tones that he knew could only belong to Athena. The Erinyes, ancient spirits of justice and vengeance, are angry with me for depriving them of their prey. The rustling and chattering increased in volume and intensity. But I command you, Furies of the blood of Uranos, to find a new and better path to justice. Become forces of magnanimity, not revenge. I call you to that higher purpose and rename you. Here, below the seat of Ares, will be the shrine of the Eumenides, the Kindly Ones. The Eumenides is the title of the third play in Aeschylus's trilogy, The Oresteia, first performed in Athens in 458 BC, I have taken it loosely as my major source for this scene. The earth beneath Pylades' feet shook. He looked up. A swirl of dust was all he could see behind the line of judges' thrones. He got slowly to his feet. Everyone around him, Orestes included, now stood. They exchanged glances. With a leap of joy, Pylades saw radiance in his friend's face. Orestes smiled and shook Pylades by the shoulder. "Seal," he whispered. "I'm back. But what happened?" "I'm not sure," said Pylades. I thought I heard... The lead judge was attempting to cover up his own confusion.
"Citizens, citizens, as chief of this tribunal, it has been made clear to me, that is to say, I have decided that in the event of a tied verdict, it is only right for the court to fall on the side of mercy and absolution. I declare, therefore, that Prince Orestes is cleared of all charges against him, and may leave with his name and honour restored."
In the great classical era of Athens, following the mythical age we are dealing with, the Areopagus was used as a council of elders and judicial court. From the days of the statesman and lawmaker Solon, round about 630 to 560 BC onwards, it constituted the highest criminal tribunal in Athens. Murder, malicious wounding, blasphemy, and treason would all be tried there.